carry out a physical union in the form of marriage. Those things were not there before. Even if they were, a child would not know that these are for what. Those physical changes try to make a person realize that he's changing, and he looks at himself or herself and finds herself in a new position. And this surprises a person, makes a person feel happy about it, or confused about it.
Even feel embarrassed.
Embarrassed or adore, start to adore oneself. Look what I'm changing. I'm becoming an adult. I'm becoming of age. So these things lead to a change in the mind also. There are physical hormonal changes which are taking place along with that. So as the apparent changes are coming in, there are changes coming within which are being caused by those physical changes or are in harmony with those changes. So thoughts and feelings are also being aroused, which are different from the thoughts and feelings which were there before.
Yeah.
So now the person has to be able to be taught in such a way that this is something natural. I mean, before...
It's okay.
It's okay. It's something natural. You have to face it. It's not something which you should get confused
or excited about.
Or embarrassed or whatever. It is something natural, and you have to manage those feelings.
Yeah.
And, of course, unfortunately, in our society, especially in the traditional conservative societies, parents feel embarrassed about talking
to their teens.
That's a difficult situation. So yes, if a parent cannot do it on himself or herself, then she or he should take the help of a person who can relate to their children, explain to them. Yes, unfortunately, again, in the West, sex education is becoming important. It is becoming that the children should be taught everything. No, not at all.
All right. So you disagree?
I mean, you talk about what the changes are. What do they imply? How do they have to be managed? But you start talking about them, how to have safe sex. Now, uh-huh. that is something very difficult. I mean, you're telling your children, okay, it's no problem, the changes are there.
So if there are some arousings, you're actually putting catalyst into it.
Exactly. You are providing them opportunities. You are providing them, showing them the path to carry out those things which are not allowed. So basically, children, adolescents have to be educated in such a way. They have to be made. Have to realize what the changes are. They have to understand what the changes are, but they also have to be taught how to manage them. And therefore, it is the duty of the parents. It is the duty of, especially, their school-going children. The schools have to also take care of these things. And of course, according to our understanding, the segregation should take place in the schools.
Yeah.
Because it's very difficult to say that you go towards the fire, sit by the fire and you don't get burnt. It's not possible.
All right. So, well, we'll discuss more on that important issue after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about the changes that take place in adolescents. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said that in adolescents, they are not just physical change, they are not just hormonal change, they are not just biological change, they are also cognitive changes, they are mental changes, they are different kind of changes, and your adolescent needs not only to be educated about that, but also he should be educated how to manage those changes.
Yes. I mean, the important thing is understanding what those changes are and how to manage them, the feelings, especially the feelings and the thoughts. Because basically, if we have taken care of the intellectual development of the child in the domain of intellectual development, cognitive development, we have to make him understand the difference between pure thoughts, truth, and things which are illusionary, imaginary. I mean, the imagination in an adult becomes very strong. And though it in a child, every child has that imaginative skill in his mind, and it is very important when it comes to constructing ideas, developing new things. Imagination is very plays a very essential role in technology, in many things, in fine arts. But that it has a downside. Imagination, if you allow it to run wild, it will cause you to think of things which will cause those feelings to arise. You will create things in your mind which will seduce you, unfortunately, will cause you to think of things which cannot take place.
Which, and it would be difficult to manage.
And it's difficult to, yes. Therefore, one has to be able to learn how to control thoughts and then feelings. Thoughts, and the best way to do is to keep ourselves busy in pursuits which are positive, learning things about things which are beneficial for us. The more we are engaged with things which are important in life, the more we can cut off those things which are not beneficial and they are harmful. So we have to, in the intellectual development and the emotional development of a child, and even as adults, we have to be able to manage our thoughts and our feelings. And that is the most important thing. Practices, actions can be managed as a result of the thoughts and feelings that we are managing. Therefore, a child is engaged in activities which keeps him or her involved in positive things, in physical development, mind exercises, management of the, playing games which create a positive atmosphere, create an atmosphere where his thought process or her thought process becomes advanced, progresses. He is able to think in a pure way, pure thoughts, pure reasoning, mathematics, philosophy, culture.
And much more.
And much more.
Yeah. We'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned for us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am with Professor Nakavi, and we are discussing about the changes in adolescence. Well, Professor Nakavi, before we discuss more, we have an audience question. This is a lady, Ferdil, from Holland. She says, "I have a 17-year-old girl. Her name is Gadir. And I have a 16-year-old girl. Her name is Mariam. The 16-year-old is very, very humble, but the 17-year-old Gadir is so, so rebellious. I don't know how to deal with them. Can you help me?"
We have a situation where one of the girls has become rebellious because it means that she, at the age where those feelings had to be managed, because as we mentioned, the changes which are taking place in the feelings, in the emotions of an adolescent, is one of them is that a person becomes aggressive, questions everything, becomes curious, wants answers, wants things to be done the way she or he wants them.
Yeah.
So they, at that age, if a parent becomes aggressive, he or she becomes aggressive in response to the aggression of the child,
things become worse.
Whereas if he or she, the parents, one of the parents or both of the parents, and it's important that they work together in unison, they work in harmony to control those these problems and issues that are being faced. Generally, the problem is mothers are left on their own to deal with their children, especially the girls, because fathers wouldn't like to get themselves involved with girls, in especially in those very sensitive issues. But yes, now that the stage of that the teenage has progressed up to 17, she has obviously passed those early years of puberty and adolescence. Now she's advanced and progressed into those later years, and she has made an opinion. She's started to develop her own thoughts. She's not just copying them. She's not ready to imitate. She's not ready to accept what the elders are saying. Now you have to become a little bit, you have to engage in an intellectual way. Reasoning should take over emotional, the emotional way of trying to control and reacting to the feelings. One has to keep his or her mind very cool, cool-headed approach, being able to understand, trying to become friendly with the child, trying to understand the reason for being aggressive. What is she looking for? There must be something she is feeling that is required. She may be feeling some deficiency. She may even be looking for a husband. I mean, she may be of the age that she requires, she must be married off.
All right.
So the parent has to understand what is she looking for. And that can only be carried out in a very subtle way, in a very tender way,
in a very
through
cool
engaging in discussion, in becoming friendly with her, becoming talking to her in such a way that we are friends. Don't think upon me as your mother. We're friends. We're girls. Let's be happy.
Yeah.
So this is, I think, the way how she could be able to manage that situation.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Nagavi, for helping us with that important stuff. Dear Sister Ferdiel, aggression should not be answered with aggression. As per expert, aggression should be answered with cool-mindedness, and you should help your daughter that her reasoning part dominates her emotional part and engage her in discussions. That's how you could help your daughter, and we will also pray for you. Thank you so much for questioning. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
The General.
He's a man of many faces named Amir Mansur Arya. This is a story of a man with many faces named Amir Mansur Arya. He believes that during the years he was active in Afghanistan, he made the key to the disintegration of Iran. The key that those who were eager to ruin Iran would come to Afghanistan from all across the world to get. Since about 150 years ago, when Afghanistan seceded from Iran, the colonizers had always had an idea in their heads. Afghanistan shouldn't experience good days after secession. The continuous carnage and instability for about 100 years in a country that doesn't have anything to do with other countries shows the old and modern arrogant powers have had some plots for the country and the neighboring areas. You may not believe it, but in recent years, he was one of the important elements for the disintegration of Iran, sometimes going with the name Arya, and sometimes with other names and appearances. Amin Mansur Arya was the commander of a terrorist group known as the Modern Iranian Army. He is a separatist who once had close cooperation with the U.S. with the goal of disintegrating parts of eastern Iran, and now he's here in Tehran. He's ready to talk about the plans to target Iran's territorial integrity. In today's jargon, Amir Mansour was a facilitator for the disintegration of Iran. To run an armed terrorist and separatist group in eastern Iran, he had the backing and support of a strange plethora of groups. From U.S. spy agents to agents under the cover of UN staffers, extensive communication with the MKO, Daesh, the monarchist whose goal was to topple the Iranian government, Abdul Malik Righi's terrorist group, the Tundar terrorist group, and also arrangement with the Mossad and some European and regional spy agencies. How and why did Arya form the army? Did he manage to establish the communication network on his own, or are there other people involved? The story dates back to many years ago. Arya left Iran for certain reasons and lived in Afghanistan for a while. Taking advantage of the vacuum in the establishment and the structure of the Afghan government, the ambitious Arya was designated for top military and security posts. Arya's characteristics were noticed by a top intelligence agent named August Leslie, who was in Afghanistan under the cover of UN personnel. Those days, Arya was known as General Mohammad Idris within the Afghan government. General Idris's relationship with August Leslie got deeper and stronger. August Leslie and General Idris, his position and facilities to carry out his own secret missions in Afghanistan. General Idris, namely Arya, was in charge of security issues during a trip by Kofi Annan's special envoy to Afghanistan and his entourage. But after a while, he realized that all missions of the Egyptian woman, who was apparently the representative of the UN Secretary General, but in fact was a senior intelligence officer, were security missions in line with U.S. espionage goals. After the U.S. military invasion of Afghanistan, the Americans directly contacted Arya. The first meeting was made in the Kandahar Air Base. Three CIA officers hosted Arya in a meeting whose agenda was to assess the disintegration of eastern Iran and establishing an independent country named the Free Balochistan. The people of Afghanistan are tired of many years of imposed wars and the looting of the arrogant and exploiting powers. They consider Iran as their safe haven. In the middle of all this, by using the soil and these people's facilities, ominous plans are being designed for the people of both nations who are in fact one. August Leslie, the American spy in Afghanistan, who played a significant role in the occupation of the country, had already told the CIA officers about the characteristics of Arya. They know how to use Arya's ambitious character to implement their nasty schemes. The seeds of forming a terrorist separatist group were sown in the meeting in the Kandahar Air Base, and an important project was launched. A special task is being planned and managed to coordinate the affairs between General Idris and the terrorists under his command on the one hand, and the other terrorist groups and spy agencies that work against the Iranian nation on the other. After a while, a main liaison was designated for communication between Arya and the Americans for security reasons. The liaison should not be an ordinary person. He had a special status in the then Afghan government to make the required arrangements. Habibullah Nurin had a completely structural relationship with the Americans. Through Ashraf Ghani's wife, he's managed to have a say in his decisions. He was a reliable person in the eyes of the Afghan president. Nurin was following up U.S. goals in Afghanistan and at the same time focused on Iran and the project to disintegrate the Balochistan province. By making the arrangements with the Americans, he helped Arya officially form the modern Iranian army and establish communications with other terrorist groups to get the project close to a sensitive stage. Now, Zina Tehrani enters the project to activate the media and propaganda aspects. Tehrani is a monarchist and a media personality. She had a close relationship with both Reza Pahlavi and the White House. She had to introduce the movement under the leadership of Arya as pro-monarchist and in fact a symbol of the monarchy that was pursuing national goals. But the network and its requirements are not complete yet. Arya is the right figure to complete the network and the chain. Psychologically, he's interested in bonding with different people. His ambition and thirst for fame are insatiable. During this process, under the leadership of the U.S., Arya got to know someone named Saadi Khalid, a separatist based in Afghanistan. Saadi Khalid had a focus on disintegrating parts of Iran. Now, the old dream of disintegrating Iran's east and west found a common ground in Afghanistan, and they're trying to make the necessary coordination. Meetings were held between Arya and members of Abdulmalik Righi's terrorist group, but all the capacities needed to be united. How is it possible to talk about dealing a strike to the Islamic Republic and causing unrest in Iran without mentioning the MKO? Shuku Ershadi, who was one of the members of the MKO and was residing in Sweden, got in touch with Arya, and hence, the coordination between the MKO and the separatist modern Iranian army was made. The MKO members asked Arya to facilitate the transfer of at least 2,000 of their forces to safe places in Afghanistan and Pakistan to complete the military part of the project. Gradually, Arya turned into an interesting figure for the Zionists as well. He was influential in Afghanistan. He has armed forces, and more importantly, he dreams about disintegrating Iran among his other ambitious plans. Ara Moradi, who is an armed separatist in the west of Iran, was assigned with establishing a relationship between Arya and the Mossad spy agency. After a while, the Saudi intelligence service also jumped on the bandwagon. But why would the Saudis give to separatists like Amir Mansour Arya carte blanche? This is a question a Saudi prince in Lebanon, close to bin Salman, has recently given a clear answer to. The Saudi prince stated that Saudi Arabia has spent a lot to overthrow the Iranian government during the past years and has had contact with many anti-Iranian groups. But the Iranian government has remained firm and has even become stronger than before. Now, we've reached the strategy of driving Iran to 5 smaller countries. Now, it comes to light why the Saudi-funded Farsi-language Iranian International has been stoking ethnic tensions and the betrayer separatism. Disintegrating the proud Iran in the Saudi network has become a hot topic, and many audiences of the network have been vocal against it, and every now and then, the guests criticize the separatism agenda of the network. But an important link for the communication network is still missing. Arya has to communicate with Daesh in Afghanistan as well. The blood-shedding and merciless terrorist movement that Amir Mansour Arya or General Idris talks about is completely under the control of the U.S. and is supposed to push forward the military goals of the plan. One day, Arya has a long beard and looks like a middle-aged Afghan man, and the next day, he shaves his beard and becomes a general of the modern Iranian army. But he's had other faces and appearances as well. During the time his terrorist network was getting complete, he received support from the CIA and disguised as a doctor named Mansour Masoudi to live in Afghanistan. In the meantime, a part of the White House budget earmarked for the modern Iranian army to topple the Islamic Republic was received by a person named Hamzipur. After the order to start the project, over 500 suicide forces and 2,000 terrorists got ready to be used in the U.S. lightning strike in eastern Iran planned by Donald Trump and his team. Trump called the Iranian people terrorists.
In a little while, I'll be giving a speech on Iran. A terrorist nation like few others.
His security advisors and foreign secretary openly and covertly talked about overthrowing the Iranian government in every gathering.
For over 10 years since coming to these events, that the declared policy of the United States of America should be the overthrow of the mullah's regime in Tehran.
Thereafter, a military attack against Iran and the modern Iranian army is tasked with executing a part of the plan. Now, the former General Idris, or yesterday's Dr. Masoudi, and today's Amir Mansour Arya, started writing letters to the UN and different countries to gain political legitimacy and set the conditions for a military and terrorist operation. But the U.S. plan to simultaneously disintegrate parts of Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan fell apart with an unexpected incident. General Arya and his first-hand and abundant information on the plots against the Iranian, Afghan, and Pakistani nations had been leaked to the Iranian intelligence officers at the intelligence ministry. It was a lethal strike to years of planning and efforts by the U.S. spy agency in West Asia. Arya's untold stories are more than what he said so far.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. Now that, with the blessed support of Allah and with the endeavor of the committed nation, the foundation of the Islamic Republic has been laid, we should bear in mind that what is important in establishing the Islamic government is Islam itself and its progressive rules. It is formidable for the great nation of Iran to ensure the implementation and protection of Islamic values in all aspects of life.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and in this program, we try to have a profound reading of Imam Khomeini's precious words and speeches. Now, in this episode, what we're going to talk about is Imam Khomeini's views on ethics and spirituals. In that regard, he says Islam only values virtue and piety. Whoever is more pious and virtuous has more value before God. Well, this sentence revolves around the value of human beings. There are several definitions and requirements for value in either Islamic or general religious contexts. While some religious texts emphasize on honesty, integrity, love, and happiness as criteria for values of human beings, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is viewing value from a different aspect. The first point about this sentence is that human's value is defined in his or her relation to God. In fact, such type of spiritual value is of utmost importance in human's life, and it is the most comprehensive aspect of viewing value. Another lesson one could take from this sentence is that if somebody wants to build his or her soul, two of the best accommodations for that purpose are virtue, or what we call in Arabic birr, and piety or taqwa. When we look at the teachings of Islam and the acts of worship, we understand that in most cases, Islam guides people towards the state of taqwa. Taqwa incorporates consciousness and fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as well as piety. Okay, let's have a short break and we'll be back in no time. Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Spring of the Truth. We were talking about the concept of value in human beings, and we said that piety and virtue are important factors in that regard. Virtue in Islam refers to doing good deeds which might be in favor of others. The Islamic moral virtues are wisdom, courage, charity, and justice. A person who has developed the four faculties within himself or herself isn't praiseworthy unless the possession of these virtues benefit other people as well. In other words, purely internal and private virtues do not have much value, and their possessors do not deserve praise. We can see that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh sees human value in both internal and outside aspects of it.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim, Islam, I be.
Allah my Lord,
His word Quran,
Muhammad Prophet,
praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear brothers and sisters from all around the world, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. I am Vitesh Roseris from Youth Station. We are Youth Generation at your service, and we're going to share our point of views with you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Brother Muhammad coming to you from the same station.
Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam. Nice to have you, Ms. Peter, together.
Yeah, for me too. So today we're going to talk about something really controversial. You know, I don't know whether you've experienced this kind of thought gap between your old, new version and your old version. For example, there are the times that you post something on social media about your thoughts, feelings, whatever, and after a long time or even a short time, you came back and you see whatever you wrote there and you're like, who is this?
It is not me. Oh, yeah.
And this feeling of, you know, large gap between your thoughts and feelings when you posted them on social media and what you are now is somehow bothering. I wanted to ask your own experience in this kind of actually topic.
When you talked about this, I remember this saying, this very famous saying that you are the master of your word before you've uttered it.
Yeah.
Once you've said it, you're no longer the master of it. And that is actually very true when it comes to social media. It's even more true than ever. Reason being that we, in this modern era, we're kind of enslaved by this notion that social media, we are much more comfortable in. So we say whatever we like. We try to talk ourselves out in social media. And we post things that we don't dare saying it publicly. But we post it.
Yeah, exactly.
Though it has the same effect and consequences, but we post it and we say stuff in social media in the virtual environment. But then after we get that maturity and we understand that, oh, what have I done? That's like the damage has been done. That feeling is actually very common, not only for like, you know, youngsters, but same goes for any age, let's say. The thing is, when it comes to experience, the more experience you are with social media, I think this you're less prone to this. But it's a problem that everyone faces.
Exactly.
It's something I have personally faced many times. I've posted, I can tell you, like, at least this, I've posted a few things previously in one of the social medias a long time ago. And there were things, you know, more political.
Yeah.
And what happens is when things on politics, this is how it works. Like, it's uncovered. It's a mystery until it's uncovered.
Exactly.
And then when it's uncovered, this is when you realize, oh, what have I done?
Yeah,
I said
exactly.
Something wrong.
You're mistaken.
Yeah, so I think it all comes back to how mature you are when you're posting stuff in your social media.
Yeah, I think it doesn't matter how much you are mature, you know. It is always something that you don't know. It is always something that you have to seek for or something like that. And, you know, there is a problem with that, posting your thoughts and, I don't know, beliefs in social media. I have a lot of problem with that. Is the superficial knowledge that we're sharing together, you know what?
Yeah.
You know, for example, there is a bunch of people together gathering and they are talking about, I don't know, something, and you know, they are thinking, talking superficially, and that is really bothering. And if you allow me, we'll go for a break and then we're going to come back and talk about this kind of pain in the neck. So dear listeners, stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Youth Station. You are listening to us on IRIB English Radio. So, dear brother, we're talking about the superficial knowledge that we're sharing on social media about our thoughts and beliefs and so on. So, have you ever done such a thing without any kind of research or, I don't know, something you didn't know, but you were kind of feeling something that you are expert in that? Only a feeling.
And you've posted something.
Personally speaking, I've had less encounters of those because being knowledgeable in the IT field, I know that some things are like undoable. You can't undo certain things. And I'm kind of precautious when it comes to social media generally because of the privacy issues and all the other issues that come around it. And in addition to that, I have a lot of friends that would really quickly get back to me on everything I say on social media. So I normally cater for them before I post anything. So I have this layer of precaution.
Yeah.
But even with this layer of precaution, yes, many a times we do become superficial when we kind of post things. And when I think about it, yes, like I said, politically, many a times, especially youths, us in this age that we're in right now, it's an age in which we normally want to get out there. We want to get our thoughts out there.
Yeah,
let the people know what we feel and believe without us, you know, properly researching necessarily. But that happened. It's very regretful, to be honest.
Exactly. You know, because you are just going extreme in that issue, especially political issue and something, and you think you know everything, you are expert and so on. This is a problem, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go through the topic of the roots and the reasons of this behavior that we show.
Yeah.
You know, if there are thoughts and that we don't want to talk to anyone, but we post them at the same time. What is this paradoxical content? Why do we do that? You know, there were a study in Harvard University that there were main six reasons for this behavior that we show. First of all, we want to exchange information. This is so easy, you know,
mm-hmm.
because in real world, this is really difficult to, for example, find someone and tell them, okay, this is my beliefs. I want to exchange information with you.
Yeah,
and this is the
true.
First reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is social support. We need social support. You know, we need somebody to tell us, okay, you're doing well, you're thinking well, you're educating, and something like that.
Just
know?
Take a point there. That social support does not necessarily come from the social media, correct?
Yeah, exactly. I do agree
so
with that.
So it's a much more general point than mm-hmm. it being something posted.
But it's easier, you know, gained in social media, I think.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
The third one is friendship. Make friends with other people. You know, I think this goal is somehow paradoxical because when you go through these social media and post your thoughts and beliefs and you are the true self that you want to be, you know, it feels like you are somehow arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it occurs to me that I acted in social media and I was in relation with some people only in virtual world and they felt like, okay, how arrogant you are. They told me.
Yeah.
And when they saw me in the real world, they were like, okay, you are kinder
than
which is yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's the big difference between the virtual and the actual
exactly.
world.
Exactly. And the fourth one is recreation for entertainment, you know, because it's as a, you know, we look at it as a hobby. And the fifth one is common interest, love the topic of the, something that we're going through because our own interest. And the sixth one is the technical reason. But the most important one is make a friend, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do agree with me, we do that to make friends, but I think it came out somehow vice versa.
Yeah, that is true. You see, we look at one dimension of it. One dimension is when you yourself feel regretful and you say, oh, what have I done? I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
But then there is another dimension to this entire virtual information exchange game is when others kind of have a peer pressure on you. So once they realize, oh, look, you believe in that? Really? Oh, you don't believe in that? Really? You don't believe in that? So these kinds of peer pressuring or this getting to know each other is also a very important aspect that we
exactly.
normally have to consider. So that also affects the point you mentioned about essentially making friends. I think what happens eventually is when you kind of get out there and you express yourself, your beliefs, your feelings, and eventually what happens is you would find people around you that are very close to your own beliefs. So I have business friends, I have family, I have other friends, I have political friends, I have friends from my classes and so on. But then I essentially know from the postings that they send, I know how I interact with them.
Yeah,
like for
exactly.
my business friend, I don't care what their political views are, I just do my business exchange with them.
This is a beautiful story. You know, there is a beautiful story about my own experience that I want to tell you. Let's skip it, you know, just for the break, and then we're going to come back.
Sure.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station. We're talking about something really controversial, about posting your ideas and thoughts on social media. And I wanted to tell you a story about my own experience on this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in reading real blogs and, you know, some personal real blogs about day-to-day life and something like that, mm-hmm. especially medical student, you know, because it's related to my own major. And once I was reading a kind of real blog from a girl, and she was anonymous without any name or any age or something.
Yeah, like half the people in the
exactly.
in the world these days.
Yeah, and I was reading. It was about, I don't know, 10 years ago. It was written 10 years ago. And I actually got to the end of that roadblock, and that girl actually passed away because, I don't know, because of cancer or something.
Oh, my.
And, you know, I felt like, okay, I don't know you. I don't know your name. You're anonymous, completely anonymous to me, but you are still alive in my mind.
Yeah.
Actually, this is the beauty of posting your own thoughts and beliefs in social media.
Oh, yeah, it is. When we look at the negative aspect of it,
yeah.
we should not forget the positive aspect.
Exactly.
Because there are always two sides of the coin. And when we consider the good things that social media has brought to us, we should also be very careful with the negative aspect. And that is with regards to one very important point within the same topic is how youths are very vulnerable to changing their beliefs just because of a post from an influencer
yeah.
that they find, and that influencer itself might eventually be regretful of what they posted, but the damage has been done. The youths have gone through that stage of believing in what that person has said. Now,
exactly.
this is, I think, very important. If we are a person or a group of persons who believe in something and we have a lot of influence in the society, I think it's... I should rather say there should be more layers of precaution before
yeah.
we post something. We should also see the consequences that happens. Because it's not only regretful for ourselves as influencers, I'm talking from the influencer's perspective, but it's very, very... important as we look at the audience, because they're going to be affected by the posts we make.
But you know, there is a problem which I think it is a kind of rooted problem that, you know, we cannot solve it that much easily. There are some influencers in social media that they post their feelings, thoughts and everything, and they're like, and you know, they feel like they're a god. They
yeah,
feel like they are, you know, the boss, and they can tell you what to do and not to do. And, you know, they act as sure as you think that this is the most correct thing in the world.
Yeah.
You know?
And you
and
see many people following them. That's the bad thing is you see many people, they let's just take some, arenas over here. You'll see so-called celebrities, right?
Yeah.
Their entire job is either to play football or to just act in movies. But look at the things that they express in social media. Oh, my, how much experience do you have in
exactly.
that? How much knowledge do you have in that? And the unfortunate thing is many of them are sometimes affected by other social medias, not research, not education, not experience, but they're just affected by others. They're affected by the vibe, and they simply just surf on the wave that is in the social media itself.
Exactly, and this
which
vibe
really
trend.
Affects the youth these days.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the recent incidents that are happening around the world, not only in Iran but around the world, you'll see it's because of these so-called celebrities in social medias would not necessarily feel regretted after they post, but the effect that they have in the society is actually regretful.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, because most of the majority of the people who are the influence of these influencers are the youth generation, you have to understand that, okay, there is good things, there are bad things in anything, and you have to find yourself.
Yeah.
And when you find yourself and you identify yourself in social media, then you can post your ideas, you can post your feelings, and you can go and share them and talk about them and contribute them. And I don't know, whatever with other people. And this
mm-hmm.
interaction, is kind of more safe when you're sure about yourself.
Us posting, that's good. But then the audience, should we accept any and everything that we see in media? Or should we consider... person who is a footballist or a person who is an actor or an actress as the role model for every single aspect of her life?
It's not like that. I do not. The fact that I shouldn't accept something like that from a celebrity. The fact is that it will affect me unconsciously, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a problem. I think that you have
yeah,
to control
yourself. Yeah, but if
you
as the audience of this celebrity,
yeah.
this so-called influencer, you're eventually giving yourself to a person. You're taking thoughts from a person that is not necessarily qualified to give you those thoughts. Don't you think that is true?
Yeah, it is true, actually. You know, but so... just tell me only one sentence about these posting thoughts and, I don't know, feelings on social media.
I'll give you one word. Be careful.
Thank you. That was really nice. So as dear brother tells us, we have to be careful in this kind of dangerous world. Thank you for listening to us. It was all the time that we have for today's episode. This is IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how Britain, in the name of development aid, spawned corruption and injustice in Afghanistan for 20 years following the invasion. And we shall also look at growing tensions between regional rivals, India and China, fueled by the construction of dams on the Brahmaputra River.
A British government watchdog report says much of the £3.5 billion aid London provided to Afghanistan following the invasion of the country in 2001 was not spent on humanitarian aid, as claimed by the government officials, but on military operations, which in turn spawned rampant corruption and injustice. This mammoth funding served to advance the broader geostrategic and military agenda of the neo-imperial powers in the conflict-ridden South Asian country, instead of humanitarian aid, relief or construction, with almost all international bodies aiding in the endeavor.
The Independent Commission for Aid Impact, a government body tasked with scrutiny of British development aid, in a report published last month, denounced the use of aid budget to fund the salaries of Afghan police and military as a questionable use of UK aid. The British government splurged £252 million on the salaries of Afghan National Police and £400 million on Afghan security services over the last 6 years of its operations in the country. Despite efforts by aid officials to stop the funding, the government overruled the move as it sought to prioritize the transatlantic alliance in line with its coalition ally, the United States. The report cited the British government documents that describe the situation as an extreme form of state capture, which benefited a narrow group of Afghan political elites at the expense of the population at large. The report added that in these circumstances, there was little prospect of meaningful institutional development in the war-ravaged country. The largest UK contribution of £668 million was to the World Bank program designed to fund basic services such as health and education, infrastructure investment, agriculture and jobs, but none of it managed to make any material difference to the lives of Afghan people.
Well, sure, they left it as in a greater mess than they had when they got there. So that of course is the responsibility of the force that had been there for 20 years. Somehow cannot just leave and say, well, you're on your own now. But there has been little indication the United States is prepared to do that. They thought that they could set up a satrap state under their direct control. That didn't quite work. So instead, now that it does have a government, which seems to be relatively in control, not entirely, but relatively in control, they would have the opportunity to try and assist to repair some of the damage that had been done by the 20-year devastation that was the occupation of Afghanistan by U.S. and British and NATO forces, in effect.
The hasty and ignominious drawdown of American and British troops from Afghanistan last August, after two decades of military occupation and horrendous war crimes, left the South Asian country on the brink of a monumental humanitarian catastrophe. For 20 years, foreign invaders exploited the country in the name of development and democracy. 20 years down the line, the country's economy is devastated, terrorism and insecurity are at their peak, and earthquakes and natural disasters have increased. All these problems have been compounded by the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. government.
Foreign powers invaded Afghanistan in 2001, ravaged its natural resources, destroyed the country, and abandoned it in complete ruins. According to the World Bank, the landlocked South Asian country is the sixth poorest in the world, with a gross national income per capita of only $500. The UN estimates that 24 million Afghans, or more than half of the population, today suffer from acute hunger. An estimated 8.7 million are at risk of famine, and 5 million children are on the brink of starvation. The situation has been complicated by the freezing of Afghan national assets by the U.S. government, the suspension of foreign aid, and a crippling economic blockade.
Well, obviously, the Afghan war was very controversial for American citizens. I mean, the number of deaths, American deaths there, the amount of treasure that was spent in the military operations in Afghanistan, essentially, you know, robbed a lot of people of not only their livelihoods, but also the lives of loved ones. This is the reason why the U.S. Really was forced to pull out because of this, the popular opposition to continued operations in Afghanistan. And but they did it in such a way that they wanted to try and go and then put it behind them and pretend it didn't happen. Now, obviously, people are aware of the tremendous cost in terms of those who lost their loved ones. I mean, this can all easily be counted. But the overall costs of that war are still probably much greater than has been indicated. And therefore, if the truth really comes out, the reaction against those forces who were responsible for it would be so great that it could really overturn the apple cart in the political situation here in the United States.
The invasion of Afghanistan, which was led by the U.S. and the U.K., was in the first place based on a false premise. 20 years of war destroyed the country and produced one of the largest refugee populations in the world, despite tall claims of development by the foreign powers. After the hasty withdrawal last year, the British government vowed to give asylum to thousands of Afghans who worked with British forces. But more than a year later, they remain trapped in Afghanistan or neighboring Pakistan, which only underscores the devastating impact of 20-year military occupation in the name of building democracy and humanitarianism.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Now, according to the British government watchdog, much of the aid the UK provided to Afghanistan between the year 2000 and 2020 served to entrench corruption and injustice in the country. Now, does that surprise you in any way?
Thank you very much for inviting me to your show. Actually, such revelation by the British watchdog does not surprise me because it is a well-known fact that much of the foreign aids and foreign money came into Afghanistan went to the corruption. That was the basic reason that despite all these efforts of 22 years, they could not build a nation, they could not build a state. All the state functionaries collapsed as soon as the Western forces withdrew from Afghanistan. So it was a well-known fact. And actually, there is another fact that the Americans and their allies, particularly the Americans, they actually supported this corruption by their decision making, and certain individuals were arrested in the Gulf.